Podcasting is a complicated profession, which is why we're here to discuss Andor, currently airing on Disney Plus. My name is Dan Morin, and I am joined, as always, by my co-hosts. Kat Benish is here. Hi, Kat.
Hi. Squig, squig, squig.
And rejoining us triumphantly for this episode, it is our good friend and co-host, Mr. Tony Sindelar, who has been on assignment.
To a medical unit, yes.
Yes, you are. You've been immersed in a tank of Bacta for the last.
Yeah, I don't know what is there a planet where they send you? I guess just the medical frigate, or possibly Kamino. If you're a clone, I don't know. But I'm back, more or less.
If you're
intact,
a clone, you have to tell us. That's the law.
Are you a clone?
Yeah, you have to tell us. That's the law.
I don't have a New Zealand accent, and I don't, I don't look like Boba Fett. So, you know, I mean, in a way, aren't we all clones of who we want to be? No, never mind. Sorry, I'm getting philosophical. Sorry, Kat.
The energy's good for the show.
Yeah, no.
Are we all clones of who we want to be?
Let's move on.
I'm a little sleep deprived. Everything's great. Yep.
Well, join the club. This is a podcast full of sleep-deprived people who talk about Star Wars. All right, we're here to talk about episode 8 of season 1 of Andor, entitled Narkeena 5. We'll do a quick 30,000-click overview of the plot and then move on to the detailed plot lines.
Actually, though, before we do that, do we want to do the questions?
You want to start with the questions?
Oh,
I'm throwing out my script, Kat. What do you want to do?
I think we start with the questions, and then we can get into the conversation. And then you can decide if you want to scrub this entire thing from the podcast.
Sounds like a lot of work, so probably
yeah,
not.
Yeah, are you just making a lot of work for the editor? Yeah.
But who edits this?
Does anybody really?
No. All right, this is the way it's going to work, Tony. We have a total of 8 questions from you. You'll have exactly, I'll say, 15 seconds to respond to each question.
I don't know who's timing this.
Can you time it? We can't do a bell, but our child is currently sleeping.
Are these one-word answers, or are any of these like an essay question I have to write in 15 seconds?
Tony, I'm not fully prepared for this.
So yeah, I'm going to go through the 6 questions you and I came together.
I thought there were 8 questions. Oh, okay. There's different stages of the questions.
I don't want to ring the bell because it might wake up the kid.
Okay.
Oh,
No matter what, we won't do.
Okay.
Okay.
Kat, you have the floor.
Okay. Watch. Okay. And Dan, can you pull up the 2 listener questions,
too? Yeah, I'm just going to warn you, one of them has a visual component, which isn't going to work great.
Oh, great. I will describe it as best I can.
All right.
Let me see, Tony. Okay. Question 1. Lieutenant Gorn, alive or dead?
I think dead, because they didn't show him this episode.
Okay. Which character were you most sad to see die?
I don't remember his name, but a rebel grad student with his thesis.
Nemec,
yes. So, yeah.
Dr. Quadpod, what came first, the name or the forearms?
Oh, God. The action figure.
correct.
Good answer. Good answer. Where do you think Vel's plotline is going?
I don't know. I was very thrown by her Coruscant garb, where she's like all like apparently secretly. I think there's a line in here where maybe she's part of a rich and powerful planet, or rich and powerful
and that's
family.
Time. Next one.
Your 15 seconds have elapsed.
Where does Bix come back into this?
Well, some of these questions were written before we saw this week's episode.
Oh, I think she might get arrested and get in trouble and need help from Cassian.
Oh, man, that's
He's
amazing.
He's so good. He's so good. All right. What does Karn cereal taste like?
I imagine that it's like really fruity and gross. I don't think purple is a good food color, except for grapes and eggplants.
What's a grape color?
Well, it's not a good cereal color.
Eggplant cereal.
And time. All right. Now, last 2 questions. Question
from listener Bill has written in with a question for all of us.
Oh, listener Bill.
Do you think Cinta killed the hostages? The family.
That
I would
is
be
a good
on Aldani.
Dan, the question was not to you.
It says, and Kat and Dan at the beginning of the question.
I didn't read it. And
we run a tight ship.
No.
Quick yes or no?
No.
No.
No. I also say no.
Okay. All right. Kay. Great.
And then last question.
All right. Last question is
so
complex.
We'll read the whole question and
is
then
is this like
we'll
a rebus?
Maybe should I text him the picture? All right.
No. It's better without the picture.
This is from listener Jay, who says, as always, I'm enjoying your weekly recap and discussion of Andor. Hope to Tony is recovering well. He's definitely missed. Although you guys are doing a great job making up for his absence.
Thanks Jay.
I know you asked for yes, no question for Tony returns, but the question that's bugging me all season isn't. The question is, do you know what these things are in the Imperial uniform? They think they've been there since A New Hope, and it seems the more important you are, the more you have. But do they specifically do anything? Well, that's the question. He says, or denote canisters. Specific rank. That's, I think these are the code cylinders beyond the blue and red squares in the chest. Is there significance that Yularen has one of them not clipped properly? I don't know why, but each episode of this show, I'm becoming more and more fascinated by the small details on the uniforms. It's driving me nuts.
And then we have a picture. And he has uneven... He does have a code cylinder on his right side that is not properly clipped.
So the question is, aren't these a plot point in Rogue One? Don't we see that these are basically like your keys, basically, that let you into things? Like
they're like
they're like a fancy kind of analog, badge that you would tap on something, right?
Or that like if you have a VPN fob.
Yeah, right. So they let you decrypt or I forget if they let you do things at a terminal or let you have physical access to rooms, but they're basically
and time.
Okay, they're space keys. Just to, space in keys. Case anyone's curious, the various squares that you have on your chest that seem to come in like red, blue, and yellow.
Yeah, it just tells you how good you are at Legos.
Yeah, it tells you how good you are at Legos. I think they've established, at least, or fans have established, that there is no continuity to them. And so there's no... I mean, I think we see in the ISB that we have people that have, like the same number and seem to be of equal rank. But yeah, it seems, by themselves, they have not been used consistently enough to connotate anything. They're not like your pips in Star Trek where, or at least whatever system
generally,
they're using.
You have...
More yeah,
generally,
is
if you have more, they seem to be higher ranked. But yes, the colors then threw a wrench in that. And somebody said the other week when they had the engineering colonel who shows up on Aldani, his are all yellow, which signified engineering or something. Okay. I don't know. Yeah,
I don't know. Grand Moff Tarkin has like a dozen of them, but yeah.
Well, he's a Grand Moff.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, so listeners, if you have any other questions that you would like us to try to answer in less than 15 seconds, send them our way. Now back to a regular... Welcome back, Tony. And now back to our regular programming.
All right. Let's do our high-level overview. This is the episode which, following on last week, Cassian has been arrested. He is sent to a prison on the planet Narkeena 5, which involves a lot of labor and stack ranking of prisoners. Elsewhere on Ferrix, Marva seems to be falling ill. Bix and Brasso are looking out for her, but they want to alert Cassian. Bix takes the risky move of using her radio to contact Luthen to look for Cassian. Luthen and Clea decide not to engage. Meanwhile, Vel and Cinta, who have also been dispatched by the Rebellion to find Cassian because he knows about Luthen, are also on Ferrix watching this whole thing unfold. Miro interrogates Karn to ask why he keeps submitting fake requests about Cassian Andor, which starts drawing some lines together. And then Miro heads out to Ferrix, where she arrests Bix while looking for Cassian. And then on Coruscant, we have some interactions with Mon Mothma on trying to move some money around still. As well as Luthen is heads out to visit our old pal Saw Gerrera.
That's right, yes.
And we have a little bit of that as well. So that pretty much is the major plot lines, and we'll go through a few of them in more detail. Let's start with Cassian on Narkeena 5. This is sort of the meat of this episode, is Cassian being taken to this prison. We have a whole like prison system detailed where there's work crews. Cassian is assigned to the one run by Andy Serkis, who is playing Kino.
Or, as I like to think, that because it seems highly improbable that they would have the same actor play multiple roles.
Yeah, they would
the
never
universe,
do that.
This is the backstory for Snoke.
The backstory we all wanted and did
just
not
works
deserve.
His way. Yeah, gets released for good behavior and just lucks his way into the new emperor position.
He works his way all the way up. He climbs the ladder,
the
starts
up.
As a prisoner, works his way all the way up to supreme leader.
He's got a lot of good management skills.
Is that how the galaxy works? It's a meritocracy.
It's a meritocracy.
It's just slight head injury somewhere along the way, but even that he overcomes.
these things happen.
Yeah.
We also meet a variety of other prisoners that Cassian's with, including, I wanted to point out, what's his name? Melshi, who is in Rogue One as a rebel operative agent, whatever. So, he's one of the ones who breaks Jin out of prison, I think, very early on, and then is on Scarif with them. And he seems to be the most, perhaps, malcontent of all the people that they in his Cassian's little group, where he's the one that everyone else seems to be like, we're super into this as like, you know, a game, quote unquote, in terms of just, you know, trying to outperform all the other teams.
Well, trying not, like, I think it's fundamentally representing, right? Rather than you're focusing on keeping yourself safe rather than worrying about the bigger picture of keeping everyone safe, right? Mm-hmm. It's actually, I think, a good metaphor for what we see happening on Ferrix as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a lot going on with this prison episode, and it shows the insidiousness of the Empire in trying yes. to create. And again, we should be clear, like, things like this do go on in the real world. Like, yeah. There is a lot of labor at prisons. I'm sure there is a lot of this sort of, it's not quite, I don't know if brainwashing is quite the right word, but there is an element of like,
they break you down so that you're not a yeah. person, right?
You're
not, so that
you're
you don't
dehumanized. Yes.
We're also going to yeah, keep you so incredibly focused on something else. Like, we're yes. gamifying it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're basically thinking your other prisoners are the enemy, not the Empire itself. It's yes. brilliant. It's incredibly yeah. brilliant manipulation.
And, you know, there's the Star Wars element where, like, haha, the floor is electric and, you know, you're doing but whatever, you're building whatever space widgets those are. But, yeah, it is at the same time, it feels like this is, you know, the psychological elements of prison today are extremely present in this science fiction fantasy prison.
And you get inured to it, too, we show, right? Like, yeah. you start off with Cassian looking really bewildered and, like, getting thrown in the deep end. Mm-hmm. And then by the end, he's like, you know, big,
he's doing
acclimated
the thing.
To the system, right? Yeah. He's like, yeah, yeah, I wake up, I drink from my feeding tube, I go off to work. Ugh. Like,
yeah,
yeah, super gross.
But it is interesting when he first shows up too, right? So he's, I do, Dan and we're talking about the fact that he, the way we learned about it, right? He keeps asking, what is Tarkina 5? What is Tarkina 5? And they get on the cruiser and like, take off your shoes. You're all thinking, he's not, he's like, why? Mm-hmm. Why take off your shoes? And then mm-hmm. they show up and they're showing those big rubber boots. But it's interesting when Cassian comes in, he's scoping the joint.
Yes.
He's yeah. scoping the joint yeah. very, very clearly. And you see the discontent even among the prison. Again, why it makes me love the show is they include unnecessary plot and dialogue. But yes. that's still, it's such rich word building. Like, the fact that one of the guards is late because they're short for another thing here, and which group takes priority for where resources go, totally irrelevant. But
I
totally
was that
believable.
Scene was so weird. I was like, is something about to happen here? Is the and it's I, just like, no, this is just our this is your glimpse behind the scenes of the guards. Oh, yeah. I think in part because you don't see them again for the rest of the episode, right? Yeah. This yeah. is not a prison oh, yeah. where the guards are walking around doing the kind of, like, the abuse is kind of, it's very abstracted, right? If you are the lowest systemic, ranked yeah. Building, or whatever they're doing, builders, you'll get zapped by the floor, and that will just happen. If you're the top ranked, you get flavor in your food tube,
yeah.
Right? And, yeah. but it's, and you know, I'm blanking on his name, but it's Andy Serkis, who is a prisoner, who is kind of like your guard walking around maintaining order and yelling at people. But it's, and even just the choice to make the prison, like, it's all white. It makes me kind of think of more of yeah. like an asylum yep. than a prison. Yep. And they have those yep. little cubicles that they sleep in that don't have doors, because you don't need doors when the yeah. floor will fry you if you get out of bed. I mean, it is both a commentary on what prisons are like now, and also extremely dystopian and just upsetting. And there's a little bit of question of how much time passes in this episode, and I feel yeah. like it's a little hand wavy because probably Cassian is not aware about how much time. But he goes from, you know, he's kind of alert, he's looking for his out, and then it's like, no, he's just in survival mode building
his
widgets.
We know exactly actually how many.
Yeah.
We know actually exactly how much time passed because he has
30 days. Oh, you're right. It's 30
shifts,
days at
which
one
presumably
point. Yes.
30 days.
Yeah. So yeah.
I think also agree with everything you say, Tony. And I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with the Stanley Milgram experiments.
Yeah.
Yes.
But essentially the idea that an MILGRAM, if anyone wants to look it up, who's unfamiliar with it. But essentially, as I recall, psychology experiment, right? Mm-hmm. Where the subjects are brought in and behind a door, there's another person who you're supposed to like help coach and get right. And if they everything, they get an answer wrong of a number set. You're supposed to electrify them. And there was no one yeah. behind the door. It was an actor, so they weren't getting hurt. But the idea of you thought you were doing the right thing, that you would commit in indescribable yes. pain. And the idea, I think you see about the guards of, like, if everyone, you see that with a guy when he first comes in, the leader or the prefect of the garrison essentially says, or the prison of, like,
uh-huh.
hopefully this is the only time that I have to electrocute you. If you just do your job correctly, then you won't have to get hurt.
I don't want to hurt you.
I don't want to hurt you, but I'm hurting you for your own sake.
Yeah, I think what's cool about this episode in terms of the way it's structured is, we, like you said, we have this idea that maybe Cassian is looking for the weaknesses. And I think it is dropping clues, as we saw with the last sort of arc where it did, you know, starting with the raid, you know, and sort of building up to the Aldani job. We're also doing this sort of slow soft peddling. We're going to take an episode to establish the setting. I think there, you know, we saw a couple things in this episode that hint that there's something else going on. Mm-hmm. There's the guys communicating with sign language.
I was going to ask about that.
Across the tubes. We don't really know what the deal with that is. Cassian scoping things out, I think, is important, as is the guard being late. I think the upshot of this is, as per what you were just pointing out, there aren't a lot of guards because they don't feel that they need them. And this is where it dovetails with our previous theme about the Empire being arrogant, right? The Empire thinks, we've got this great system. It's foolproof. Like, all we need to do is basically beat you into submission. And, like, we don't even have to, you know, basically touch you.
Well, they also walk him in, and as he walks in to get basically booked and checked, he walks past an entire shoe tree of those shoes. He could have just grabbed a pair. Mm-hmm. But again, that arrogance shows.
But I think that comes into play. And then the part where they say, like, look at those, you know, one of them comments,
yeah,
like, look at the,
it's all psychological, right? They're up in the window, and it's like, he's the guard in the window is not looking down. The guard in the window is like is reading his email or something, right? Yeah. And they're like, they're laughing at us, and it's like, they barely know you're there.
Yeah.
So I think the psychology.
I just want to say, this is an interesting point that I think is going to build to this idea that maybe, you know, again, ties in with our themes of rebellion and the idea that, like, yeah, there's not that many of them. And if we can get, you know, sort of organized sign language, whatever, like, maybe there is a chance that we can overthrow these people. But then again, this show always zigs when I think it's going to zag. Yeah. So who knows how that might play out.
I like the moment where the prisoners are kind of asking Cassian about, like, what's going on in the outside world. What do you know about this? And he's like, he was kind of in hiding on that vacation planet.
I was getting high on my vacation planet.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, he doesn't know anything. You know?
Well, I think it's also fascinating. Every time someone tells the story of what happened,
we've
heard, like, oh, the garrison got taken out, they killed everyone, they stole 100 million credits. The story keeps getting amplified every time it is retold.
Which works to the rebels' favor, right? I mean, this idea of, like, it sounds more and more impressive as time goes on, and that seems to be building some sort of popular support, right? We had Marva last week talking about being enthused about the garrison robbery and how that sort of started her whole, like, path, you know, encouraged her to have her own little acts of protest. And now we have the prisoners who are hearing these stories. And of course, the irony with him not knowing anything about this new restrictive law is, of course, he's the reason that we have this new restrictive law.
Do you guys think he regrets being part of the heist?
No, because that's the thing. Like, last week, he did not get arrested really because of the heist. I mean, indirectly, yes. But, like, I think it goes down to this idea of, like, you can't escape the consequences of your actions somehow. Like, even if it's this really long, like, karmic, you know, route before it actually hits you, he tried to walk away from this, and it kind of still bit him.
I was a little surprised in the previous episode when his adopted mother was, like, all excited about the rebellion that he didn't say anything about what he'd been up to. But, you know, Cassian's not a chatty guy. he keeps a lot of stuff pretty close to him, and it seems like it mainly comes out when he kind of, like, boils over, as it were. Because there is a lot of, like, what do you want, Cassian, right? And I mean, I think part of it is, Cassian doesn't know what he wants, right? Like, he's kind of... I mean, and even, like, you know, he goes to the island vacation planet, and I don't know. He seems a little lost there, right? Yeah. So it's like having, you know, whatever hundreds of credits that he was given didn't actually solve his problem, right? I mean, he gives the talk to his mom, where he's like, we have money, we can go wherever. And she's like, well, where's there to go? And he's like, well, at least we could go somewhere not cold. And he does that, but it's not, he doesn't know what to do with himself, right?
Right. And he can't go after his sister, because I think, or maybe he will, but Marva basically dismissed that as a fantasy in the last episode.
Yes.
Right.
So it's not actually maybe a real purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that's really, you know, well put together in terms of, like, and I enjoy as well that they said, like, you know, they ask him what he's in for, and he's like, nothing.
I don't know.
Yeah. And they're like, a lot of that going around, right?
You know? Yeah.
All of this is sort of the trumped up incarceration charges, and all this is sort of an interesting, it gives you another indication, and I think this will link in with some of our other plots, about how the Empire manages to become so repressive. Like, we're told they're repressive, right? You go back to the original trilogy, right? Like, you're told they're evil and they're repressive, and Darth Vader's wandering around, like, arresting people or whatever.
We don't really know what that looks like.
But yeah, you don't know, because, like, on, you know, the most you see is on, like, Tatooine in A New Hope, where Luke, there's stormtroopers roaming around looking for the droids, and they're like, oh, there's a checkpoint here. That's weird, right? Like, and that's where you get the idea, like, oh, maybe it doesn't get everywhere, but now you're getting a really good look into, like, that's what this... That's what life under this regime is
and
like.
And if you just like look at the stormtrooper the wrong way at the checkpoint, you too could end up for 6 years in Tarkin alive.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's and also, I mean, I think, you know, we've seen it before where it was all, it was like, you know, we see it a little bit with this, the rebel cell on Aldani, right? Where it's like, these are people who have had people, family murdered by the Empire, right? And clearly the Empire has murdered a lot of people, but not everybody in the galaxy has a family member who's been murdered by the Empire. But maybe a bunch of people have people that have been put in jail or had their land taken away from them or, you know, saddled with unsustainable taxes or something like that, right? But it is interesting that, you know, this is seems to be what Luthen wants in terms of he's kind of like baited the Empire to be more oppressive, to which is kind of, I don't know, it's a little messed up, right? It's like we need the Empire to be worse for the rebellion to have more traction. Is a little messed up, but I mean, I guess that's the path.
Well, I think it's the line was like, if you go too slow, it's like the frog in the pot, right? And it's pulling on that thread. I think you actually point out something that's really interesting, right? And we'll talk a little bit more about this too when we get back to Bix later in this episode. So fascinatingly, right, all the prisoners, I think Luthen's strategy, actually seeing it play up, makes sense, right? So everyone on the prisoners there, many of them are there because of this new law, and yet when they talk about the attack on the garrison, it isn't like, oh my god, like, whoever did that,
they screwed us all over,
right? Exactly. Instead they have hope and excitement, even though that led to the law, because I think they recognize how they appropriately assign blame to the Empire rather than to say the people who did the act themselves, which compares with Ferrix, who I think hasn't done that, but I think Bix has started that journey, like, wait a second.
Where everyone was mad at Cassian for basically bringing the Empire down on them.
Right, and I think, I don't know what's different there, because I think either it's fundamentally, it's because the people in prison realize it was all, they're there for lies and no good reason, and the Empire's there on trumpet charges, or since they've lost everything else, they're not afraid of losing anything. Versus Ferrix, I think people still have a lot to lose, and they still might, and I think Bix goes through this, and we'll talk about this later. I think they still are living with the lie that, oh, if we just follow the rules,
we can get out of
we'll be fine. Yeah. We'll get out of it. And like, you're the troublemaker for breaking the rules, versus the people in the prison. They didn't break the rules, and they're still doing the consequences of it.
The color on that, too, the other little tidbit that we see that really, I think, shores that up, is the one guy who kills himself, right? Steps onto the floor. Knowing it's on. And I think that shows you the point of the despair, right? Like, there are people in that prison who feel like, I literally don't have anything to live for. I'm stuck in this prison. There's no chance. As they point out at one point, like, I think they say to him more or less, you're never getting out of here, right? Like, it doesn't matter what you did or how long they said your sentence was. That number doesn't mean anything. So you see that this is what it does. It breaks people down to the point where maybe they just feel like they can't win, they can't get out, they have nothing left to live for, and so they take, you know, the only route available to them. And that's the despair we see, as opposed to, as you said very well, I think, on Ferrix, where it's like, we can still make choices that will allow us to survive this. Like, we have options right now, or at least we have the illusion of options.
Right. And then I think that's what Luthen is trying to push people over, is say, you have that illusion is an illusion.
Right, and you need to fight back.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about Mon Mothma, because the plot line there dovetails a bit with this.
Let's talk about the great cutting back and forth between the fancy dinner parties, the embassy party, and prison.
Especially in the scenes where they talk
many
about
parties.
The new law, too, right? That's all they do on Coruscant.
Yeah.
This is a really small point here. Again, I just want to... We'll talk about craft later, too. Just like, I forget exactly. I think it was towards the beginning. Here it is. When Mon Mothma, they're standing in a circle, and Mon Mothma's trying to whip votes. They're standing in a circle, but the camera's constantly moving, so they add a lot of energy. But they're cutting it back with a scene of Cassian standing in a line, and they're actually moving, but it's a single camera and the camera doesn't cut around. And just, again, loving how they bring that energy and motion side by side with each other in completely different, and just like contrasting those two environments. You know, I mean, loving the craft of this show.
And dialogue too, right? I mean, a lot of their discussing is this public order law, and they're having very academic discussions about it. Well, oh, if you've done nothing wrong, there's nothing to worry about. This law is just there to protect us from all the rabble rousers and whatever. And, you know, we're intercutting that with, of course, all the people in prison who are there on trumped up charges. Meanwhile, Mon Mothma is trying to get her money out, but it seems like that's getting harder and harder.
Yeah.
And then we have her husband, who still seems very sketchy all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes. And then another interaction with her daughter,
Lita?
Again.
Yeah. I don't really know where that's going.
She looks like she actually wanted to talk to her mother about something, but then her mother essentially dismissed her. Oh, sorry, Tony.
You know, I mean, as Dan is fond of saying, the show always like sets up stuff and then goes in a different direction. So my brain wants to be afraid that the daughter is going to do something that's going to like jeopardize Mon Mothma's political career. But it could just be background flavor that shows that, you know, she does not, you know, eventually she's going to be living in a abandoned temple on Yavin. So, you know, I guess it's just establishing that maybe living the gilded life on Coruscant is not a perfect fit for her anyway, right now.
I had my conspiracy theory in this episode, which I think I shared with Kat, but I will put it out here too, which is that and this sort of links in with the next plot on Ferrix. I was wondering if Vel might have a relationship with someone that we have seen otherwise, and my two biggest, you know, candidates were Luthen, although I think that becomes less likely. I mean, there's almost sort of an estranged father-daughter relationship between the two of them, where she's like, I want to go out on my own and be a rebel leader. And he's like, fine, I guess I'll help you with this. But I also think there's a not impossible chance that she is Mon Mothma's like elder daughter or something like that. Because they mention in this episode that she and Perrin are married at like 15 or something.
15,
yes.
Young.
Yeah. And so there is the suggestion.
Which also, it seems like you have to start your Senate career in Star Wars as a teen. Like, it is not allowed.
Well, the junior Senate, yeah.
Well, you know, you're allowed to get old in the role, but if you are not a senator by 17, it's not happening.
Well, you're over the
hill. I still have a lot of questions about how all these elections work.
I will say, was a senator. Did he get elected at like 15?
Well,
what does a 15-year-old Palpatine look like? Oh, that's an upcoming Star Wars.
Can you only be elected if you're under a certain? You could either be the incumbent or under the age of 20.
I will say, I watched a couple episodes of the new animated Tales of the Jedi, which I don't know if we'll talk about on this podcast or not, but the incompetence / corrupt senators are a theme in that one as well. And it does seem like basically, my reading between the lines, and maybe it's different on different planets, is that though it seems like you are elected, it seems like in order to be in order to get elected or to be a candidate or something, it seems like there's a very gradual transition from royalty, right? It does not seem like you are of the people. It seems like there's a lot of corrupted evil senators out there. So my assumption is basically, you know, you had people that were probably kind of your multi-generational leaders who were, and then they have, you know, at some point they've joined the Republic and are serving as Senate, but it's, you know, it's not actually, it's like the Kennedys, Dan.
Well, I think it's more like senator's a title, right? And so like every planet can decide how they get there, so that's how we have both a princess and a senator.
Also, the Empire, I think, is the other aspect of that, which is the idea that like maybe there is an argument from them that like they're obviously de-emphasizing the Senate's role, and so making it more and more ceremonial, and then additionally by having, you know, basically children in it who they feel like easily swayed and easily to influence. Maybe that's a way of exerting more direct control from the emperor rather than devolving it into the Senate. So anything else to say about Mon Mothma? We don't spend a lot of time with her in this episode.
Squigs.
Oh, squigs.
How do we, are we anti-squig or pro-squig, Kat?
You know, I think I blinked and missed the squigs, but I think I'm anti-squig. I don't think I need things in my beverages.
I'm undecided on squigs.
I mean, interesting, like everyone else is drinking this Chen. I think we're also getting the sense that Chandrila might actually be quite a cruel planet.
It doesn't feel good, right? Like the things that we've seen about it, it's fairly limited, but at the same time, it does not feel like a society that is, or at least this part, the people we're seeing from the society are very much the cream of the crop, and like you get the feeling almost of a perhaps corrupt society where there's like a rich aristocracy who's very lavish, and perhaps maybe we don't really see what the people of Chandrila
more
are going
through. Well, and, like,
and also,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
We don't actually see Chandrila, right? We have all the rich, fancy people from Chandrila hanging out on Coruscant, which is especially a little interesting compared to, say, I guess the one senator with a heart of gold. Well, I guess maybe there's a couple, but you know, in the Obi-Wan series, it seemed like Bail Organa spent a lot of time on Alderaan, right? But Mon Mothma seems like, and her husband don't seem like they get home much, right? So,
and they also don't pay attention to Coruscant that much. There's that whole bit about looking out the window and ignoring the view and all of that, which it feels very political maneuvering, but at the same time is like, they're not really concerned with what's going on here.
I will say it feels, I'm reminded a little bit of Canto Bight and the casino planet where we see the rich people out of touch, but with a level of elegance in this storytelling that is goes a little beyond that, is what I'm saying, right? You know, you don't have to show people like partying and as warmongers to show that, you know, the rich are out of touch with what's going on in the galaxy. So just have them enjoying a nice squib.
Let's talk briefly about Luthen.
Oh yeah,
and Saw Gerrera. So we see Luthen basically in this episode, A, ignoring Bix's call for help because, you know, and Clea, who proves to be more of a hardliner here.
Yeah.
We had originally wondered when that Clea and Luthen were aligned on trying to kill Cassian. I think this episode answered that very clearly they are. And I think we also see Clea's not just his assistant. She's, I think,
a partner
in her own right, and very forceful. Like, she definitely reports to him, and she makes it very clear, like, you need to tell me to do X. But very, very smart and very realpolitik, or what has to happen in order to keep everyone safe, and giving him a wake-up call that he needs.
Yeah, right. I mean, their cover story,
to answer the call, but
the cover story is that she's the assistant in the gallery or whatever it is, but they are, it does seem like much more of a kind of partnership. It's not a military hierarchy, and you know, she is not blindly taking orders so much as, like, you know, they are conferring about what they need to do, and I mean, I think it reinforces, like, everybody in the rebellion has a slightly different motivation and a slightly different attitude and a slightly different basically tolerance for what is and isn't acceptable. And that is interesting, because I don't think that had ever been, maybe a little bit in Star Wars Rebels, but this is the most direct, like, let's show how it's, we're all fighting the big evil, but there's a lot of conflict about what that's going to look like, what we're willing to do, what we're willing to sacrifice, what we, you know, what we want to do to get that happen is a big theme in Andor, which I feel like is being well established and explored. So
I agree, and I love in the sort of the scene with Luthen and Saw Gerrera, like, the two things that I love from this are one, Saw basically saying, Luthen, what do you believe, right? Mm-hmm. Luthen being like, I don't care. I just want us all to be effective and work together to get something done. Because it's very much a impression of something is better than nothing. But I also have to give full credit to Luthen coming to the intro of immediately giving Saw Gerrera credit for the heist that he knew that he did himself. That was
delightful.
So well
done. Delightful. Delightful.
Delightful. Oh, so good.
The interesting part of the Luthen Saw interaction, what I really enjoyed was we'd start to see a better picture of Luthen's angle here, right? I mean, and I love what this links into Miro at the beginning of the episode, and we'll get to Miro's plotline in a minute, but they've basically identified that Luthen exists.
Yes. And they have a name for him too.
Axis, because he is literally the axis that all these groups, he deals with. What we learn is that he is dealing with all these different groups, and he is trying to get them to all work together. And I love that this is the fundamental tension of this era, is the rebellion is not organized.
No.
There's all these little groups there doing their own thing, and they don't like each other, and they don't want to work with each other.
Well,
right?
They all think Saw was great. Like, I'm the only pure one. Everyone else is
compromised. Oh, right? Yes. Oh, Saw. Oh, Saw. Yeah.
And I love,
only
all,
me. And he believes
Forrest
his
Whitaker
hype.
Is so great in this role and has done. I love that he has managed to assemble this role from such a patchwork of different performances and different eras in Saw's life. You know, he's got, like, we've seen him in Rebels as a younger man. Yeah. You know, we've seen him in, you know, we saw him briefly in Bad Batch and Clone Wars, played by a different actor, but also in the video game, and then in Rogue One as, you know, sort of at the end of his life, and all of these different aspects of him being like, he is the hyper militant, right? He is the one who's like, I am just out to do as much damage as possible. But he's also not being effective, right? Yeah. Because as Luthen points out, so much of what he's doing is just like picking at little stuff, right? He's not actually doing any damage.
He could take on something that he was never able to take on before if he just teamed up with this other guy. Or lady.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And he's like, I don't want... And literally, like, Luthen's like, I will give you all this stuff for free. And just, all you have to do is meet with the guy.
You don't even have to do it. Just meet him, right?
And he's like, I don't know. It sounds like a lot of commitment. Anyways, I thought this scene was great. And I saw some people commenting these, like, people saying, like, I don't even understand what's happening in this scene. It's just the verbal fencing and back and forth and negotiation. Oh, all of that seems to me so well scripted. And, you know, what are you talking about when you're not talking about what you're talking about, right? Like,
yeah.
Anyways, you guys were talking about the, like, you know, joking back and forth about the raid and, like,
so
who
good.
Did it. And all of that is just so well executed to my mind because everyone's cagey. Nobody trusts each other. Mm-hmm. And that's why the rebellion isn't working right now. So I thought that was cool. I'm sure that's not the last we've seen of Saw.
I hope not.
And so this version of Saw, I was trying to piece together the timeline in my head, because this is, how far are we before the events of Rogue One here?
We're still about
5 years?
We're still
five
around
years,
5 years, I think.
Because this seems like
a much has passed,
pretty younger and healthier Saw Gerrera, because the Saw Gerrera in Rogue One has... like robot legs and a breathing apparatus, right? So
So
something happens to him at some point that causes him to.
And I'm forgetting, we see him very briefly in Rebels. That would be after this, I believe.
Yes.
When do we see him in Rebels? Okay. I've forgotten that.
Yeah, he's like is he on Geonosis? He's on the bug planet.
Yes.
And he wants to kill the last bug egg, and Ezra doesn't want to let him do it. It's kind of a weird cameo, because he's just kind of there. I mean, he's not with anybody else. It's strange. It feels it may not have been the best deployment of that character, but it was fun to see him.
It's a brief two-parter, I think, where you see him show up and, like, essentially it's to highlight the difference between his much more militant approach to as opposed to the rebel cell, which is very, like, you know, a little more touchy-feely. They got a little more force-sensitive stuff going on. But it shows, again, the sort of disparate natures of that. So that would probably be a couple years from now, I think, because that takes place in between this and Rogue One.
Uh-huh.
But I think, you know, this to me seems like we're not just dropping Saw in so that you remember that Forrest Whitaker's a character in Star Wars. It feels like there's at least a couple more parts to that. And, you know, I would not be surprised to see that stretch through next season, too.
My hunch was season two of Mila Hunter is going to be a much bigger player. But again, who knows? Maybe the next four episodes are just about Saw Gerrera.
It's all Saw Gerrera.
Still waiting for the Mandalorian episode.
Should we shift gears and talk about Ferrix?
Yeah, I was wondering, had we heard of that planet before? That was the one thing I wanted to look at.
Segra Milo, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
It did not ring a bell.
Because he's on I had to look it up, Jeddah in Rogue One.
Yeah.
Even though I thought
it did kind of look
like
the same.
Similar.
He even had the same guy stationed as his guard outside.
Yep. Enjoy that Luthen makes fun of him for living in caves.
Yeah.
You're not doing so well. Now, this is the first appearance of this, apparently.
Interesting.
So I think it's just their base, essentially. Because he tells, Luthen tells his computer to take the long way around.
Yeah.
Real-time Wikipedia-ing, this is the only mention of Segra Milo.
Yeah.
All
right, let's talk about Ferrix, and let's fold in the ISB plot a little bit, too.
These are great. And again, it's... just so much fun. I love loving it all. Miro is a great character.
Yeah, so, I mean, this episode opens basically with Miro hauling in Karn, to talk about like Karn, who's been working in his fuel purity job. Yeah.
But still using it to make somewhat relevant requests for this Cassian Andor, who's known for impure fuel.
Is he fired by the end of this episode? It just seems like he should probably be fired.
It is probably a misuse of Imperial resources.
100%. It is definitely, right? Yeah.
Yep. Oh, but it's funny, too, because I think what I enjoy about it is Karn is actually kind of doing what Miro did in the last episode, which is like, I am taking a route around this to try and figure out the information that I want at any cost, right? Like, I'm ignoring sort of the rules or whatever that were set up and going behind people's back and trying to do this because I think it's the right thing to do. He's also the only one who can, like, draw the line to Cassian, which now Miro obviously has. Karn tries to, like, make a play like, I could be of use to you, and Miro's like, I will arrest you the next time I see you.
Do you think that's the end of Karn?
No.
I don't think that's the end of Karn. We've sent him up a lot. He's going to keep Karn
is forever.
Or something.
Yeah. No, he's and he does point out, like, he is the only one who knows Luthen's voice, right?
Mm. Oh, right, yes.
So he is, which is, I guess, a tricky thing because you can't hand over a picture of his voice or anything like that. So Karn is still kind of the key to all this. But yeah, he may lose his job and have more time to sit at home staring at the image of Cassian Andor.
Maybe he'll go antique shopping and hear Luthen's voice and put it all together.
There is still the kind of almost comedic incompetence element of this, of, you know, they're looking for Cassian Andor, or maybe they don't know they're looking for Cassian Andor, and it's like, you have him, he's in jail.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know? We just, Tony, I'm sure you heard in our previous episode, it reminded me of that bit from The Wire in season one with Avon Barksdale, where nobody knows what he looks like. And I think it's the same thing here, where it's like, we know what he looks like, but we don't know where he is because he's just using a fake name, and you arrested him for other things. Your job is done.
Do the Imperials know what he looks like?
Well, presumably Karn handed over that. Yeah, they do, because at one point they put the hollow up in the meeting.
They do in the middle of the ISB meeting in the center.
Okay. Because there was a bit of a delay.
Version, yeah.
Yeah. There was a bit of a delay where only Karn had the image, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
But they put up Cassian as, like, if he's the mastermind, he wants nothing to do with the rebellion whatsoever. Yeah. He would be so happy if you just left him alone for the rest of your lives. But he is your one link back to Axis that you have.
Yes, exactly.
So, all the money.
So Miro is taking this and running with it and essentially being like, I'm going to go to Ferrix. I'm going to find this Cassian Andor and essentially use that to find Luthen. We have this, shift, right, where Miro finally shows up on Ferrix. And then having arrested Pak, who is the guy whose shop Bix uses to do her illicit contacts with Luthen and stuff, does not go well because Bix, we see a scene where Bix gamely tries to outrun the bunch of the stormtroopers, and it seems like maybe has, and then turns out to have been arrested.
Yeah.
I was a little bit confused. So Bix gets arrested, and maybe we'll learn more in the next episode. I was not entirely sure what Bix was being arrested for / why Bix hadn't been arrested any time in the last month, in that they seemed to know her, but I wasn't sure if they linked her to the secret radio in the
trash shop. Because they had set up in with the ISB when Miro's essentially doing the briefing for what she wants. Mm-hmm. And the head leader of the ISB,
Yularen,
is basically saying, list the things, including, I think, essentially
Codebreaker, droid.
Codebreaker,
and, like, keeping an eye on all the radio in and out, which is essentially how I presume they discover her. Interestingly, though, we also know they can get where the radio's been receiving to, so I wonder if they're putting Luthen at any risk there, though they didn't lay any threads down for that. So that was, I figured, was the radio.
Yeah, I think
they're
essentially
going to track it back to her with the package that Miro put together.
Right, so I assume exactly what they did. They surveilled that. They knew there was a radio signal going out. They knew it was from the shop. They interrogated Pak, who gave up Bix.
That makes sense.
Essentially, I think, and under duress, but, and then they pulled her in.
And this goes back to, I think, what we were talking before, is I think Bix is beginning to realize that she was trying to do the right thing, but she's also now raised the stakes for everyone on Ferrix to get into trouble, and I wonder if she'll draw any parallels to what happened to Cassian. That being said, again, I love Mira Stagecraft again. Clearly, she knows what she's doing with the interrogation, when she's like, no, keep him here, and as soon as Bix walks in, she's like, what are you doing? Get him out of here. Just, again, brilliant.
Yes.
I don't want to like her, but I love her.
Well, yeah. She's extremely competent, which we know, you know, you have a soft spot for that, Kat.
I do.
So, yeah, you know, morality, competence. Yeah, you know, so.
Well, I think it helps to have a character that you kind of, for lack of a better word, sort of root for on the Imperial side.
It's so like, weird. I mean, and it's very well done that we are rooting for, you know, the evil person, right?
Yes.
But she's not evil. She's not an idealist. She just wants to do her job well.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's, I think, what it comes down to is she, as I said last week, like, she's not going around talking about rebel scum and all this stuff. She's like, no, my job is to just put these pieces together and figure out what's going on. And, like, yeah, she definitely still has brutal means. There's no question about that. And it's kind of intriguing to see that in counterpoint slash corollary with the prison scenes, right, in which we see the overall, this is what the Empire is doing, and she's part of that machine, for better or worse. Mm-hmm. You know, but to point out, the machine does not grind evenly, right? Like, there's different levels of the ways that the machine takes people apart and, you know, figures out what's going on. So, I agree. I thought the stagecraft there was pretty good. And it does set the scene now where, like, she's got somebody who has a concrete link to Cassian. But again, the irony, as we said, is Cassian can't get any of these messages because he's in jail.
So my hunch of what's going to happen is basically there's going to have to be a prison break. And essentially they'll have pictures of everyone who escaped from prison.
And they'll be like, we had him. Dang it.
Keef. His name was Keef. Yeah.
You think they'd invent fingerprinting or something?
Chain codes, Tony. Chain codes. Where are the chain codes?
Yeah.
I guess they've been invented. Bad Batch happened before this.
Everyone should have a change code at this point right now. Unless they're in the Outer Rim. So.
Well, who knows? Maybe, you know, Ferrix doesn't seem like the kind of place that does a lot of change. Maybe the change code hasn't made its way there yet. Other thoughts, other topics that we didn't cover?
We get a little bit with more with Val and Cinta.
Val and Cinta.
Yeah.
Yep.
They seem, you know, the relationship doesn't seem like it's, I mean, I think, you know, it's being strained by the events of the day.
When we were watching, I think two lines in, Dan and I turned to each other and was like, I think Vel's a lot more into this than Cinta is.
maybe, but I mean, but Cinta's also the one that's kind of like no compromises, right? I mean,
well, I mean, into the relationship. Yeah. I think we meant into the relationship, right?
Like, there's, Well, I mean, I think
she's definitely more like.
I mean, I think Cinta even says at one point, like, you know,
this
comes first, right? And our relationship is second. Yeah, I did wonder about, like, so, you know, because they've been on Aldani, and Vel at least has been at Coruscant, and now they're on Ferrix, and I was like, you are zigzagging across the galaxy, like, I'm worried that you're, like, you know, you think you need to silence Andor, but I'm worried that, like, you're being in a lot of places that maybe you don't want to connect the dots on, and it's like, maybe you'd be better off just, like, going into hiding, but clearly they, and it's like, you know, it's too bad they didn't have the plan to, for, you know, Vel to kill Cassian back in the doctor's office or somewhere. But I guess that the show would be a lot shorter if that had happened.
You got to read in your operatives on all your thoughts there.
You know, I think a goofier show would have a scene in an episode or two where, you know, Cassian is like in a warehouse and Vel and Cinta bust in through one door and Miro busts in through the other door. They're all putting guns at each other because it is again the, you know, Cassian being hunted by two groups, but conveniently in jail is interesting.
Once again, everybody wants Cassian Andor dead.
Yeah.
I like this scene a lot. It's brief, but we get a couple really well-drawn pictures. Not only their relationship, but, you know, we know Cinta is the hardliner. We saw her kill the Imperial Colonel.
I like that pull. The fact that pulls through was really nice, that they really had a good sense of what Cinta's character, who she is.
And that last scene where she's like, hey, I'm going to stay here and stake out this location. And you see her, like, looking at through the blinds at Marva's house.
Yeah.
Basically, like, she is, I mean, there's no question in my mind that if she finds Cassian, she'll kill him. Like, there's no question. And we've established this character is perfectly willing to do that if she thinks that it's for the greater good. Whereas Vel seems definitely shakier on that.
Yeah. Which is interesting because Vel is the leader of the cell, but nominally, but. But Cinta is the kind of the deeply held conviction one. It's kind of a strange disconnect. So,
Well, we still don't know why Vel is doing what she's doing, though. We're getting a few more hints of it. And I think, again, and, they do. Sita does come around and says, like, she does care about this relationship, but, like, the rebellion comes first. Okay. Again, they just have a nice scene there together. But the implication that Vel may just... One could say, and I think Cinta says that you could say you're just a rich girl, mm-hmm. maybe from Coruscant, who is just looking for an exciting adventure. I don't think Cinta actually believes that, but there we get a little more about Vel's background, about what she's doing and why she's doing it.
We think the implication is she's slumming. She's a dilettante. Yeah. She is a rich lady who never really had a problem other than maybe an idealistic sort of situation. And, decided that they would join the rebellion on a lark, whereas Cinta seems like, you know, we said stormtroopers killed her whole family, I think we learn, and during Aldani, it's like she Vel's, is in this for real.
Yeah. Yeah. Vel's motivations are political, Cinta's motivations are personal.
Personal.
Yes.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So that's watching that play out, I think, is gonna be interesting because we do now have all these different factions. And I agree, I don't think we're gonna get to the warehouse busting in, but I do think there's gonna be some challenges because, you know, at a certain point maybe the rebellion also realizes, well, if the Empire wants Cassian that bad, there's something more we need to get out of him or something, maybe he's got more value than we thought.
We know Melshi eventually joins Saw Gerrera.
Melshi does join. He joins. He works with Cassian.
Okay.
He's a rebel intelligence officer.
I was wrong about that. Yeah. But the, it's interesting too. Cinta doesn't have a connection to Luthen. Cinta's connection is through Vel.
Correct. Yeah. Although they mentioned, Clea mentions in the week ago or 2 weeks ago that, you know, she recruited a bunch of people and that Cinta is doing what she's supposed to be doing. So, like, there is some knowledge there, but Vel is the connection to Luthen, at least. Yeah. Yeah.
So where do we think this is going to go next?
I think we've got two more episodes in the prison before it kicks off based on just the general structure. So I think this week we might start to see some unrest in the prison and realize that, like, yes, the system works, but maybe there's something here that's like undercurrents of something going on and people are the prisoners are perhaps get opened up to the idea of of trying to make a break for it, a riot or something. But I think in last several episodes being any indication, that won't play out until 2 weeks from now. That's my guess.
Tony, what do you think?
This prison break seems inevitable. But I think we've got this little triptych of episodes, right? So I don't know if the prison break is next episode or the episode after, but it seems inevitable that something's going to happen here. I'm curious how much longer they can kind of play out what the story is in the prison. So maybe we'll have more focus on other things happening, say on Ferrix or other places next week. But yeah, Cassian doesn't stay in this prison forever. We know that. Yeah. Yeah.
I was going to say, Cassian, this is a show pivots. Cassian doesn't get out till just before Rogue One. And he's in the prison for the whole time. The show is now about
Orange is the New Black.
Yeah, Mon Mothma and Saw Gerrera.
Well, that's not interesting, too. The you'll notice the prison uniforms are orange and white, which I believe are rebellion colors. So I wonder if that passes through. Yeah, I would agree. I think he has to get out of the prison. I assume it's going to be done through force. Though it's 6 months. It's 6 months or no, 6 years. So he definitely has to get out in the next 6 years. I thought it was 6 months, like maybe just the whole term.
It used
term.
To be 6 months. That was the implication, but now it's 6 years. Yeah.
So yeah, I predict one of three things. I think the question is if it's a prison break, whether other people externally are going to get them out or if it's going to be internally driven. I think knowing Cassian, I feel like internally driven is more likely, but I think there's a question, is Melshi already part of a rebellion and what was going on with that sign language?
Yeah, I wonder about that.
And then again, if there's a broader subcurrent that he's going to get recruited into. And then the other option is, it's actually not clear if the vote will go through, right? So hear me out. What if there's the political angle whereby...
Mon Mothma's vote. Is Mon Mothma's vote important?
Well, it's the one against... It's against the new legislation, which is the PORT.
Oh, I thought it was the crackdown on, like, the space lanes or whatever.
Oh, yeah, you might be right. Anyways, that somehow, in fact, they overturned the sentences and he gets released after 6 months. Dan shaking his head against me.
I don't think so. This doesn't feel like the resolution of this episode is, we passed the law and everything's great in the Empire.
Early release.
We believe in the role of a Congress, a functional Congress.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, does the Senate actually get to do anything that the Emperor doesn't agree to?
No.
Yeah.
So yeah, so but I agree. And then I think we're also looking at the directors and the writers. So,
yeah.
The director of the most recent episode, was that right?
The writer of this episode was Bo Willimon, who worked on House of Cards. And this is a part of like we had that one weird episode last week that was directed by the guy who directed, I think, Crown episodes, who comes back to direct the last two episodes. But this is part of sort of a Toby Haynes, who directed the first three as well, is doing these three. So I think it seems clear that this arc, this little mini arc.
Yeah.
Is, you know, going two more episodes.
But that implies the last two episodes, I think, are going to probably be much more back in Coruscant. Again, more like the Crown, a little bit more political. Potentially chasing of, can they find Axis?
Right, and I think that the other big question is Ferrix, in just terms of like, does Cassian come back? Does Ferrix sort of try to shake off Rule? Or, I mean, honestly, this is the other thing that was given a little bit of a tip in this episode is they mentioned Marva gets sick because she's looking at the tunnels under the hotel to like open them up for the rebels.
Yeah,
which I kind of adore.
I love Marva,
but I have a feeling that hotel might explode by the end of the season. Yeah. Is my guess.
Chekhov's tunnels.
Yeah,
I don't think it's a good. I don't think it's a good scene. And then, yeah, there's a lot of plays. There's a lot of moving pieces here, and they're slowly tying them together. And I think again, the pace of this show is such that 12 episodes, you really like. They're taking their time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, that is this week's episode. We'll be back to talk next week about episode 9. Of Andor. As always, if you'd like to send us some questions that we can answer in 15 seconds or more if we happen to require more,
I will pick an arbitrary number out of a hat every week.
You can email us at acp@theincomparable.com or hit us up on Twitter at @ACP_cast. Tony mentioned that there's the currently airing The Tales of the Jedi is a 6-part series of animated shorts, which I know Kat and I have watched the first couple episodes of, and we'll get back to. We might do an episode just sort of wrapping that up.
I think we should. After, Tony, if you're up for that, talk through sort of all 6 episodes.
Yeah, maybe after Andor is concluded.
They seem to basically be, for people who haven't checked them out yet, Ahsoka and Count Dooku origin stories, and but with that Dave Filoni twist of... I can find gems within the prequel and polish them and show them to you. Because when you tell me Count Dooku origin story, I'm like, but I've watched them and I was like, oh. So it's Dave Filoni, in addition to being an amazing storyteller, he sees things that I don't think anyone else sees in those prequels.
When others ask us, would walk by and say, ugh, he's like,
what if I turn that sideways and put a fresh coat of paint on it? No, there's some genius in that, where he takes the prequels and makes them better. It's because Count Dooku is just like, I mean, he's basically just like a vampire, right?
He's Christopher Lee thing.
He's just being spooky and evil, and it's like, okay, what if we actually showed you over 3 or 4 like 11-minute episodes? The Tales of the Jedi episodes are not short. They're not even 22 minutes. Like, what if we give you the backstory of how he became spooky vampire dark Jedi? And it's like, what? That character has things in him? And it's Dave Filoni. Yeah, he'll you know.
Yeah.
There's a reason that every time we were watching him, Kat kept referring to him as Saruman.
Yes. So
I can't remember his name. He's Saruman.
You can't remember a name like Count Dooku? Is that not the most memorable Star Wars name?
No, Christopher Lee.
Christopher Lee.
All right. Well, we are wrapping up for this episode. And as always, I would like to thank my co-hosts. Kat Banish, thank you so much for being here.
Squeaks for life.
And Tony Sindelar, so glad to have you back with us. Thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure to be back. No squigs for me.
Please do not send us your squigs. We have plenty. Although I will say, if you go to StarWars.com, they actually have a recipe for making squigs. So knock yourself out with that. Thank you, everybody out there, for listening. We'll be back next week. But until then, may the Force be with you.